Welcome to This Is Money Podcast. I'm Georgie Frost, and joining me today is editor Simon Lambert. And coming up, the mortgage crunch. As rates hurtle higher, should you take a tracker, overpay, or fix for longer? And are we witnessing a buy-to-let bounce back as landlords buy more homes than they sold at the start of this year? Also today, should you try to get a social broadband deal? And we reveal the best and worst home insurance providers. But what makes a good one? And does anyone ever check this stuff anyway before they buy? Don't forget you need to stay up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app.
eToro is a social network.
No, eToro is an investment platform. Fly me
to the moon. It's both. That's social investing. In other words, it's where millions of people invest in stocks, share ideas, strategies, and beyond. eToro, the power of social investing. In other words, download eToro today from the App Store or Google Play. Your capital is at risk.
But first, there is only one direction that mortgage rates are going at the moment, and it is not down. Since the first base rate rise back in December, the interest rate on the average new two-year fixed mortgage has risen by 0.5% from 2.38% to 2.89%. That's according to MoneyFacts. For equity-rich homeowners, or those looking to buy with large deposits, the difference is even more pronounced. Now, given that we're expecting the Bank of England to move a few more times this year, expect that figure to rise even further. So what can we do to manage this rise in mortgage rates? Simon, firstly, a bit of an economics 101. Why are rates going up?
Mortgage rates are going up because interest rates are going up. And interest rates are going up because inflation is also going up. And central bankers are trying to combat what has now become persistently high inflation rather than the transitory inflation that they were hoping for. We had figures out this week that showed CPI inflation has now reached 7%. I mean, that is a bumper number. The biggest figure we've seen for inflation in 30 years and an indicator of why the Bank of England has raised interest rates three times since it started lifting rates at the tail end of last year. There is the suggestion that the Bank of England will now pause in terms of raising rates. But there is also now another suggestion emerging that with inflation continuing to come in not only high, but above expectations, that they might raise rates again and again.
Yeah.
In the US, we're seeing a similar issue. And obviously, the US leads the global markets. Inflation there is running even hotter. Also, the Fed has begun to start tightening rates there. And once you look at that, mortgage lenders are facing higher costs themselves in terms of securing money to lend out to customers. And so they are raising rates as well. But also what's going on here is that they know they can kind of get away with raising rates a bit and making a bit more money because there is a lot of competition in the mortgage market. And that has been something that has brought rates down substantially because banks and building societies have plenty of money to lend. They've got pretty strong balance sheets and they're very, very eager to go out and lend into what is a fairly hot property market and make some money. It's a good time for mortgage lending. There's also quite a lot of people who want to borrow though. And the housing market's been doing well. And there's also a big rush to remortgage with perhaps more people remortgaging than you might normally expect to coming off the back of a fairly busy mortgage market 2 years ago. But also coming off the back of the fact that people see considerably more incentive to do so at the moment. And so I think banks and building societies are looking at this and going, well, we don't need to keep bumping down rates to get borrowers in. We can maybe bump them up a bit and make a bit more money.
Give me some figures. How much extra is this that people will be expected to pay a year as what rates are at the minute?
It all depends on what mortgage you're coming off of, right? So we are still in a scenario where lots of people might be coming off mortgages that are at a similar rate to the ones they're being offered now. But we're also in a scenario where some people will be coming off mortgages that are actually cheaper than the ones they're being offered now. And that's something that we haven't seen for some time. We're looking at people are probably looking at maybe potentially an extra 50 quid a month, something like that, which isn't a huge sum of money compared to most people's monthly payments, but it all adds up. That'd be £600 a year. And it's also 50 quid a month that they might not have because they're also seeing their energy bills potentially go up by 50%, or in some cases, like me, because they came off a fix at exactly the wrong time, their energy bills doubled. And they are seeing more money go out of their pay packets this month in national insurance. They are seeing their food bills going up. They are seeing their petrol bills going up, and then they are facing having to pay out more money on their mortgage.
I know that some deals that you can get are tied to the Bank of England rate rise, but is it literally, if it goes up by 0.25, you can expect your mortgage rate to go up? I'm just asking that because while you're saying it's 50 quid extra now, well, we're getting predictions that the base rate could go up 1.5 or 2% even by the end of this year. What will that really mean for how much we're paying? 50 quid now, that could be 100, 150 maybe?
Yeah. So mortgage rates don't move directly in line with the Bank of England base rate. What will tend to happen is they're influenced fixed rates, certainly, more by swap rates, which are rates on the money markets that heavily influence the cost of borrowing for the banks and building societies. And that then gets passed on to consumers. Those move a little bit more in terms of expectations of what will happen to interest rates in the future. So you can see a scenario where the Bank of England base rate doesn't change, but swap rates go up because expectations of an interest rate rise in the future increase. Or you might find that they go down because suddenly that rate rise, those rate rises start to get pushed further away, or the expectations are dampened. You've then got supply and demand, as we were talking about just now, mortgage lenders who may be keen to get lots more business in. There's an effect that usually happens at the tail end of the year where it's not a bad time to get a mortgage because lenders are trying to hit their targets for year end. So there's a lot of different factors that come into play. But generally speaking, you are seeing mortgage rates going up roughly around the kind of like what's happening to base rate thing, but it's not directly immediate. If you've got a tracker rate that tracks the Bank of England, that will go up. If you've got standard variable rates from different mortgage lenders, they will often put them up by the same amount as the rate rise, but they might not. They might put it up by more. They might put it up by less. You probably won't put it up by less. They just tend to do that when they're cutting the rates. And then the fixed rates coming to the market, it's a case of looking at all of those and working out which one is right for you, because also certain lenders may be better for some people than others. This is where speaking to a mortgage broker comes into play, because it's much harder nowadays to just go out there and do it yourself due to the way that affordability checks are constructed. To do an execution only mortgage, as it's known, is a more complicated task than it once was. And a broker will look at all of the different rates that are on offer on the market, and they'll know which ones might be better for you. They can help talk through the whole, should you fix for 2 years, should you fix for 5 years, should you fix for a different period of time. And you'll only have to do one set of all of those affordability questions rather than doing multiple sets with multiple banks and building societies. There are a number of brokers, there's loads and loads of mortgage brokers out there, not a number of, there is loads and loads of them out there. Some of them will charge you a fee, some of them are fee free and they get their money from commission from the mortgage lender. All of them will get commission from the mortgage lender, some just charge extra fees. This is money, we have a partnership with London and Country, which is one of the biggest ones. It's fee free, no obligation. So if you go to thisismoney.co.uk/mortgage-finder, you will find our mortgage finder tool where you can put in the details of what your house is worth, how big the mortgage you need, what period of time you want, how long you want to fix for, and it will show you what the best deals are that you might be able to apply for. The next step would then be, if you were going to go down this route, you would then want to speak to the broker and they would then ask you some more questions, and then they'll say, well, actually you might be able to get this one or you might be able to get that one. There's other tools that do this. I'm obviously telling you about This Is Money is one, but it gives people a good picture of what might happen to their finances, what they might be able to apply for, maybe how much they might be able to borrow if they're trying to buy somewhere, or if they're remortgaging, what the difference in cost is going to be. And just to put a bit of context on those difference in costs, as we were talking about a minute ago, if you were coming off a 1% two-year fixed rate, which many people were able to secure with a £200,000 mortgage, you would have been paying £753 a month. If you shifted to a 2% fixed rate, you would now be paying £847 a month. So that's nearly £100 a month more. Mm-hmm. On a 25-year repayment mortgage, which is quite a lot of money to suddenly be facing coming out. And the best deals around at the moment, you're looking at fixed rates around the kind of just below 2% mark and just above the 2% mark. And these are for people with big deposits. So it might be people with 40% deposits or 40% equity in their homes. And not so long ago, those rates were hovering around the just below 1% mark or the just above 1% mark. And we also had the figures, as you mentioned earlier, showing that 5-year fixed rates are now perversely cheaper than 2-year fixed rates.
Yeah, let's go there now, shall we? Why would that be the case?
Firstly,
we're talking here about Halifax particularly, though. They've launched 5- and 10-year mortgages, which are cheaper than their 2-year. Mm. Are they the only ones so far?
Well, there's a couple of things coming into play here. One is that there is an expectation that interest rates in 2 years will be higher, but interest rates in 5 years may not be. You know, the interest rates are going to peak probably in about a year or two's time and then come down again. Interest rates tend to move in a cycle. We've forgotten about that because we spent so many years not actually putting interest rates up. The other thing is that the 5-year fixed rate market is really now the highly competitive one. There's been increased demand over the years for 5-year fixed rates. The 2-year fix has still remained Britain's most popular mortgage, but the 5-year fixed rate has been coming up hot on the tracks. And now actually for many lenders, I would imagine that they're probably doing more 5-year fixes than they are doing 2-year fixes. So because of that extra element of competition there, lenders have to compete that little bit harder to get the borrowers in. But it is definitely a strange scenario where you can fix for longer at a lower rate. That's not the normal way of things.
So is it a good idea? I mean, let's look at how to manage these rises. I mean, they're still, surely in historically terms, that's still a pretty good rate, no?
Oh, yes. Mortgages are still, historically speaking, cheap. I mean, any of our listeners who recall the interest rates of the 1990s will certainly be tearing their hair out as we talk about rates dramatically rising to 2% on mortgages. Even people who took out mortgages in the 2000s will be looking at these and going, they're cheap. My first mortgage was a 5-year fix at 4.99%. And at the time, that was considered a really, really good deal. Obviously, they are substantially cheaper now. But we have shifted out of the scenario where they just keep getting cheaper every time you remortgage into they've gone up quite a bit. The thing for people to think about when they're considering how long to fix for is, are they likely to move? If they are likely to move within the next 5 years, then it may be worth them taking a shorter fix. You can take a mortgage with you. Most of them are what's known as portable, but you will have to get the lender to assess the new property and agree to lend on it. And if you want to borrow extra money, you'll probably have to do that at a slightly different rate. So sometimes it can be a little bit tricky, but it's not impossible. And it might be worth you going, okay, well, I can overcome those hurdles because I think it's worth me locking into this rate for 5 years rather than taking the shorter fix. If you don't think you're going to move, and most people don't actually move that often, then a 5-year fix is probably one of the better options, in my personal opinion, because the security that it gives you of knowing exactly what your monthly payments are going to be is something that's worth having. And also because 2 years goes really quickly. We always underestimate that, quite how quickly 2 years goes. 2 years ago, we were all stuck at home at the start of the pandemic.
Right. God.
I mean, that doesn't feel like that long ago, does it? I mean, it feels like a lifetime at the same time, but it really doesn't. It really doesn't. Just think about how quickly those 2 years have gone. That's how quickly your mortgage would have gone, and you'd now have to remortgage again. And you'd have to pay another set of fees as well. That's the other thing that people need to factor in is over a 5-year fix, you pay one set of fees for the five years. With a 2-year fix, you're going to pay one set of fees at the start, another set of fees at year two, and then you're going to be lined up for another set of fees at year six, which by which time, obviously, your 5-year fix would have ended. So I think there are all those things that come into play. And if you're not sure about it, this is, again, where speaking to a mortgage broker comes into play, because they will help you to decide and help you to work out what's right for you. Some mortgage brokers will say to people, well, actually, you're better off taking a 2-year fix, because once you finish the 2 years, you will have moved down a loan to value bracket, and then you'll benefit from cheaper rates at the end of it. The only thing to watch out for is to consider, is this mortgage broker telling me to take a 2-year fix rather than a 5-year fix, because this mortgage broker wants me to come back and get some more business out of me in 2 years' time rather than have to wait 5.
I suggest if you're worried about that, then I probably wouldn't go with that mortgage broker. There's some other things that you can do. One that pops up is overpay your mortgage. Is that a good idea?
It can be a good idea. It's certainly an attractive prospect to people getting mortgage-free quicker. The thing with overpaying your mortgage is that you can't get that money back in most cases. There are some flexible mortgages where you can overpay and then take the money back out. An offset mortgage is a good idea if you want to be serious about overpaying, because in that instance you set your savings or your current account against the mortgage and you only pay interest on the balance. You're not earning interest on your savings, but hey, who's earning that much interest on their savings these days? And generally it tends to be quite tax efficient as well, because you don't pay any tax on the benefit that you get from paying lower mortgage interest. But offset mortgages are fewer and further between than normal mortgages, and the rates can be higher, and they are ideally suited to those who might end up with fairly large current account or savings balances for long periods of time that they can set against the mortgage and really take advantage of it.
Finally, is it worth a tracker or a variable rate?
I mean, we all like a punt, don't we? We all like to gamble. I struggle to see much attraction in trackers or variable rates at the moment. If I were to go for a variable rate mortgage, I would always go for a tracker, because it is linked to the base rate, ideally, plus a certain percentage. So you know what you're getting. If you just go for a lender's variable rate mortgage, then sometimes it's called discount rate mortgages because they're linked to the lender's own SVR minus a bit. You are at the mercy of the whims of that mortgage lender. They can move the rates around however they want to. And it's much better to be at the mercy of just the Bank of England rather than the Bank of England and the mortgage lender. Once upon a time, I think trackers were quite attractive because interest rates were either A, likely to go down, or B, not likely to move much. And I, in fact, had two tracker rates for years, largely because they were lifetime trackers and I wanted the flexibility to be able to move without any early repayment charges. But I now have a fixed rate. I decided that trackers were not something to continue with in a scenario where interest rates were probably only going to go up.
Yeah. All right. Well, let's continue with the housing theme, Simon. And another really interesting pattern that emerged over the start of this new year, it relates to landlords. It's been a rocky time for landlords since 2016. They've had to contend with the second home stamp duty that came in then. Obviously, changes in tax rules on mortgage interest, and now we have upcoming rules on energy performance. As a result, a number decided just to up sticks and leave. They'd had enough. But between January and March this year, landlords bought more properties than they sold. They bought actually 14% of all homes sold in Britain. So is this the sign of a bounce back, Simon?
I don't know if it's the sign of a bounce back, but it's certainly interesting that there appears to be a bit more appetite from landlords for buying property. I suppose it might reflect the fact that they're watching house prices go up quite rapidly.
Yes.
And thinking, oh, I'll have a bit of that.
Rental yields and all that sort of thing are going up rather.
Yes, exactly.
9.6% or something in a year.
Yeah. I mean, the problem with doing it off the back of thinking, well, rents are going up and house prices are going up, I'm going to jump in and do this, is that house prices might stop going up, there is certainly a question over how much more they can continue to go up, but we've been asking that question for quite some time. And perhaps rents, you know, are going to stop rising as well. If you're going to do buy to let, it's a long-term investment. It's not a, I'm just going to try to profit from quickly rising house prices, or, oh, look, rent's going up, I will try to profit here. But I think that what we've seen is tax and regulatory changes have weighed pretty heavily on the buy-to-let market. You pay a lot of money in stamp duty, extra money in stamp duty, to invest in a buy-to-let. The ability to offset mortgage interest against your tax has been removed for higher earners to the point where you can only get a 20% credit. So it's effectively only a basic rate thing. And this has changed the picture a lot compared to what buy-to-let looked like before these things came in. But they've now been in for some time. And I think you're now starting to see landlords or potential landlords assessing the market and going, okay, well, I'm even factoring these in, I think that this is a decent long-term investment for me, and I'm going to go for it. Whether it proves to be a better long-term investment than other things, such as investing in the stock market, remains to be seen. Certainly the yields look fairly attractive. I mean,
but it depends where, isn't it? Because I mean, there's a lot of variation, regional variation. There always is with houses. Know your area and where you're likely to do well.
Yes, exactly. And one of the questions always is do you invest in the same area that you live in, or do you invest somewhere else? There's two schools of thought on that. One is that you're likely to know the area that you live in better than any other area. You'll know the places that are popular, the places where people want to live, the things that they want to be nearby. You're on hand to do anything you need to the property. Even if you've got a letting agent managing for you, you might prefer to be closer to the property. It might be that you want to do some work. You've found a property that you think you can improve and you can add some value to. That's going to be a lot easier if it's relatively close to where you live rather than at the other end of the country. There is another school of thought that says most people are already quite exposed to the property market in the area that they live in through owning a home there, and therefore they're better off treating this properly as an investment and going, well, I think actually I might live in the southeast, but I think Liverpool is a much better place to do buy to let because house prices are cheaper, yields are better, and yes, it might be 3 hours away, but that doesn't matter. This is an investment. It comes down to a matter of personal choice, I think. As with any investment, buy to let has to be considered very, very carefully. And the returns can look and sound very, very attractive because people do it with borrowed money. So they get leverage. So whilst you might buy a £200,000 property, you might only put £40,000 into it. And so any gains that you make from when house prices go up by £10,000, you're actually making a £10,000 gain on the 40 grand that you put in, not the total 200, because you didn't pay out the total 200. But the flip side of leverage is that it can also magnify your losses, and homes are more expensive compared to wages than they have ever been in this country, and you need to be very careful about buying stuff when it's expensive.
Indeed you do. That's it for part one.
I'm joined now by Sam North of eToro to tell us a little bit about what's been going on in the markets. Sam, what's been going on in the markets this week?
Hi, Simon. Well, this week you haven't had to look too far to see a headline about inflation. With the UK and US reported multi-decade high readings, which are now prompting central bankers to step in and raise interest rates at a more aggressive pace. Now, these high inflation numbers weren't necessarily a complete shock, though, but when you add that with the geopolitical situation, supply chain issues, rising interest rates, COVID-related lockdowns in China and a French election, it doesn't paint the best of pictures. Now, from a glass half full point of view, some of these sort of negative drivers are priced in. So any less bad news, and I actually feel like markets could move higher on a bit of a relief rally.
And what do we have coming up after the Easter weekend next week?
Yeah, so moving on to next week, from a scheduled perspective, we have Chinese GDP from quarter one, which will be quite interesting following the lockdowns, which we just mentioned there. We also have retail sales data out of the UK from the month of March, which investors will keep an eye on. But as we've now kicked off earnings season, that is going to draw most of the attention. From a scheduled point of view, of course, the main risks, they remain, and any developments there will influence the direction of markets. But some of the main earnings that have been released next week, you've got Bank of America, Netflix, Tesla, Nestle, and American Express. Now, the expectations of these are actually relatively low, so any surprises will be most welcome by the market. Like you said, bank holiday on the Monday, so a shortened week, but should be an interesting one.
Welcome back. To help with the cost of living crisis, Sky has launched a basic social broadband tariff to keep people connected, even if they're struggling to pay the bills. These types of tariffs aren't new and can provide average discounts of around 50% for more than 4 million eligible households. Yet only about a quarter, if that, sign up. And this is largely due to a lack of awareness that they even exist. So Simon, social tariffs first, just explain.
Social tariffs are discounted broadband packages, and they're available to an estimated 4.2 million households, those who are in receipt of universal credit. However, most people haven't got the faintest idea that they even exist, and they could save you quite a lot of money. And the reason why they exist is because broadband is considered a necessity nowadays. It's considered an essential. And in order to make sure that people have essential services that they need, even if they don't have much money, then all of the operators offer these cheaper deals. But it's definitely worth looking into if you could potentially qualify for it, because it could save you quite a lot of money.
Okay, let's go into Sky's offering then. What are they particularly offering? Who is eligible? I assume the eligibility criteria is pretty standard across the board for these sorts of tariffs. If not, educate me, Simon.
Yes. So in order to get Sky's deal, you need to be getting universal credit or pension credit. The basics tariff costs £20 a month, and it comes with Sky's fibre broadband and an average download speed of 36 megabytes and an 18-month contract. But if you need to leave before it ends, Sky says they won't charge you any early termination fees on their broadband. So that's actually a pretty good deal compared to a standard broadband package, and well worth considering if you could qualify for it.
So the issue that we have here, and I think it says in your article, something like 86% of people don't realise these even exist. And it reminds me a bit of the basic bank accounts, that banks don't advertise it because they don't really want to, right? Why would you want to advertise something that's cheaper? It means you get less money. What is actually going to happen about this? Are they going to have big banners? Surely this should be something that when you sign on for universal credits or anything like that, that should be told to you. But saying that, is this the first time that Sky's offered it? How many companies do offer this?
Well, you can get these deals with BT, with Community Fibre, with G Network, with Hyperoptic, with KCOM, with Sky, and with Virgin. And TalkTalk has a TalkTalk broadband for job seekers, which is free. But yes, most people will be completely unaware of this stuff. And as with many of these things, it then comes down to, like you said, are companies going to be that interested in telling people about, hey, we've got this actually, this much cheaper service that you can use? Probably not. So it becomes a public service thing. It you know, becomes Ofcom maybe needs to get more of the information out there to people, but also becomes behoven on people like us to write stories about it. And what was very interesting was that this Sky broadband story that we did this week on the social tariff was very, very well read. So it does indicate that there is quite a bit of demand out there for them, or certainly quite a bit of demand for paying less for your broadband. The problem is that broadband, whilst being one of those things that you still can switch, unlike energy bills, which you pretty much cannot at the moment, or it's pointless doing so, is something that people very, very rarely do switch.
Yeah.
They take out a deal and then they stick with it. And they see the price go up and they still stick with it. And the price goes up again and they still stick with it. We should all be switching broadband far more often than we are. However, we do have certain concerns over things going wrong when we do switch broadband. And that's what I think holds a lot of people back. They see it as too much hassle.
100%. And it's also something that goes on in the background that you don't really think too much about. I am a serial renter, as you know. So I'm always changing broadband provider. There was one that on, I think for the first 4 months they paid me to be with them. They were so awful. But it, I mean, all of this does highlight just how essential broadband is. Yes, look, it's not going to cook your meals or heat your home, but it could give you a job. It could give you access to your bank account, access to your friends, access to everything now.
Yeah, and it is considered an essential. I mean, it is considered an essential service for people. And if you just think about how much problems you have when your broadband goes down, then it highlights the difficulty that we have in not being able to do stuff online. And also the other problem is if your broadband goes down or you don't have broadband, then you might start having to do things on your phone. And if once you bust through your data package, that can cost you a small fortune.
Exactly. All right, then, we're going to leave that to one side and let's focus on insurers. The best and the worst. Home insurers in the UK have been revealed by consumer group Which? Good news for NFU Mutual and Saga customers, not such great news for those with more than. But what indeed makes a good or bad home insurer? And I'm going to ask you this, Simon. Do you bother to check this sort of information out before you get your home insurance?
No, absolutely. Hardly anybody ever does. And I must admit, I'm not sure how much checking up on this I do. I do check up on the policies. Generally speaking, looking at, if it's buildings insurance, looking at the important stuff in there, the amount that you're covered for, the what the deal is on subsidence and stuff like that. With a contents insurance policy, I tend to just look at how much am I covered for and will it cover my bike? And I don't really tend to, and maybe the personal possession stuff, but people really don't look at the overall customer service, the how likely an insurer is to pay out, the what's going to happen when I actually need to claim on this insurance, despite it being something that they actually probably switch a reasonable amount.
Unlike
broadband, where nobody ever switches their broadband provider or their TV provider or hardly ever does it, a lot of people do switch insurance almost on an annual basis. If they go and do a comparison, their policy comes up for renewal. Rather than paying the renewal quote, they go do a comparison, they see what the new price is, and they move to that company. But do they give it any more thought than what the cost is or this one's cheapest? Probably not that much. I don't think so. Because the problem is you don't really know until you actually try and claim. But with something like this, where, for example, you've got NFU Mutual faring best with a total score of 79%, then it's maybe worth considering something like that. NFU Mutual, Saga, Lloyds Bank coming in third.
Yeah.
You know, LV's home insurance and home insurance plus policies also perform strongly. And this is a Which? Report, so it's asked people, you know, what they think, the service that they've had and so on. And it's worth seeking out this kind of stuff. Even if you just literally do a comparison, find out what the cheapest insurers are and do a quick Google on some of them to look for customer service or problems or things like that. But the tips for choosing home insurance are, one, don't assume most policies are similar. Don't just presume that every single one of them will do exactly the same thing. Like I said, you need to look at individual stuff. Like, so for me, it's important that my bike is covered or something like that. Look at the level of cover that they're giving you, what the deal is for personal possessions outside of the home, for example. That's a big thing for people nowadays because people are often walking around with thousands of pounds worth of stuff in their bags or their pockets in terms of laptops, phones, all that kind of stuff.
But I always forget that. I always forget that. I think, oh God, you know, if I get my phone gets stolen, have I got mobile phone insurance? You think, well, you're probably already covered. Same way, if you know, probably covered it when you're abroad with that sort of thing. But no, I still try and load upon load my travel insurance and covered for a lot of this.
And accidental damage as well. Are you covered for accidental damage? So some policies will cover you for different types or different levels of accidental damage. And you know as a person what you're like. If you're the kind of person who's more likely to drop a laptop and break it, make sure you go for the policy with the really good accidental damage. If you're the kind of person who has never dropped a laptop and broken it, maybe look for the one with the really good accidental damage, because it's your time to drop the laptop exactly. and break it.
Yeah, that's good. I'm so glad you said that.
And then, so this is the next tip, is to work out what you need from a policy. So actually think about this and engage with it. I know we hate doing stuff like that, but do actually sit there and think, well, hang on a minute. What do I actually have? What do I actually need to be covered? What do I actually do? You know, and then the obvious one, shop around or haggle with your existing insurer. Don't just take their renewal quote. They're not meant to be stinging people on renewal quotes anymore, but it's always worth haggling. And do a comparison. A comparison site is a really easy place to go check how much an insurance policy is likely to cost you. And I would say, whether it's your car insurance or your home insurance or any other insurance, before you renew it, always go do a comparison to check what the prices are. It might not be that you go for the cheapest one on the comparison site. It might be that you go for a different one. For example, when we recently did our car insurance, we didn't take the cheapest one on the comparison website that we used, because we went for one that had a lower excess, and also one that covered us for, I can't remember what it was, but there was something that it covered us for. But I can remember the one that we didn't take out. The one that we didn't take out was the one that came up as one price on the comparison site, and then when you clicked through, it was £15 more expensive.
Which, is that because you clicked other things, or literally that was just... Oh, wow.
It was this one provider, I can't remember their name, otherwise I would actually name and shame them, and both of their policies that came up, and this was a, you know, on the comparison site search that we did, when we clicked through, they were about £15 more expensive on their website than they were being shown in the comparison results, and that didn't happen with any of the other insurers.
Wow.
And also check the insurers that aren't on comparison sites. There's a couple of them.
The like Direct Line?
Direct Line, exactly. Yeah. Always check the Direct Line price as well.
All right then. Good tips there, Simon. You can keep up to date with all the latest breaking running news and extra tips. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app. And if you have any comments or questions for the team or anything you'd like them to look into, Simon?
You can email us at editor@thisismoney.co.uk. You can tweet us at thisismoney or come to thisismoney.co.uk/podcast to join in the debate and read the comments.
And if you like our podcast, why not rate us on iTunes? It helps people find us.
eToro is a social network.
No, eToro is an investment platform. Fly me
to the moon. It's both. That's social investing. In other words, it's where millions of people invest in stocks, share ideas, strategies, and beyond. eToro, the power of social investing. In other words, download eToro today from the App Store or Google Play. Your capital is at risk.